Good morning, and thank you for that really delicious welcome. James Higgins, I feel like I just got a massage. And Mark and the band, thank you so much. It's just really beautiful. And thank you, Reverend Patty and John, for and all the other leadership here at Vision for inviting me into this amazing family. It just feels good in here, and that good feeling is hard to create. You have to kind of allow it. And I appreciate all of you being here this morning. I want to think today with you about the two faces of God. Now, I feel a little sheepish coming before you this morning to speak about God, because God is one of those things that is so shrouded in uncertainty and confusion that one often feels that it's best probably just to shut up about the whole darn thing. And because the more you talk about it, the more you can feel it slipping away. And, you know, God, whatever it is, doesn't seem to be something that fits into these little brains of ours. As the great philosopher St. Augustine said, if you comprehend it, it is not God. That's how mystics talk. But here I go again, and I feel a little bit like Charlie Brown. You know, Lucy's setting up the football and saying, come on, Charlie, this time I'll hold it. I swear. And I get ready to, you know, kick it through the imaginary uprights. And I start running, and she pulls it away. And again, I'm flat on my back, dizzy and embarrassed and gasping for air. And that's how I feel whenever I try to talk about God, dizzy, embarrassed, and gasping for air. I'm really building this talk up great, aren't I? Yeah. You're thinking now might be a good time for a 20-minute bathroom break, maybe. But there's something behind all the confusion that still intrigues me and keeps pulling me in. Now, do you guys remember that wonderful PBS video series called The Power of Myth? With Bill Moyers and Joseph Campbell. This seems like that kind of crowd that would know what that is. If not, look that up later. Joseph Campbell, one of my personal heroes, the great scholar of mythology. And so in one of the episodes of that series, the episode called The Mask of Eternity, Bill Moyers says, let's talk about God. And Joseph Campbell, with that devious little grin on his face, says, yes, let's talk about God. And here's what Joseph Campbell said. He said, God is a thought. God is a name. God is an idea. But its reference is to something that transcends all thinking. The ultimate mystery of being is beyond all of the categories of thought. So for Campbell, the God word or the God idea is simply a placeholder, and can never contain or be the thing to which it is referring. In the same way that a map cannot be the place. And then Campbell went on to say, the best things can't be told because they transcend thought. The second best are misunderstood because those are the thoughts that are supposed to refer to that which can't be thought about. The third best are what we talk about. So as you listen to me speak this morning and take this all in, remember that we're at least three layers away from that which we are trying to talk about. It's enough to make you quit the whole thing and just go fishing. And yet here we are like Charlie Brown again with Lucy racking up the football. Now, when I get stuck like this, I often turn to the traditions of ancient India. Because in ancient Indian religion and philosophy, they understand this conundrum, this problem. And they build some scaffolding by which we can climb up out of our confusion and into increasing clarity, hopefully. So let me show you what I mean. So here's how they do it in the Hindu tradition. They have two distinct yet interrelated ways of talking about, thinking about, apprehending, or experiencing God, or ultimate reality. A personal God and an impersonal God. Now, they don't put one over the other. They just sort of leave them both there. So at the top of the metaphysical heap of reality, at the top of the hierarchy of being, is the sacred formless source of all things, called in Sanskrit Brahman. Brahman is the formless ground of being out of which all forms arise and to which all forms return. And in Hinduism, or Vedanta philosophy, if you prefer, Brahman holds that place, that ultimate place, in that in the Western traditions, in the Abrahamic faiths, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, is held by God. So Brahman and God are sort of corresponding notions in these two different traditions, or two different ways of thinking. And in India, there are two ways of thinking about Brahman, again, personal or impersonal. In Sanskrit, Saguna Brahman or Nirguna Brahman. In other words, Brahman beyond all qualities and attributes, and Brahman with qualities and attributes. One you can think about, and one absolutely beyond thought. That is a possible solution to all of the religious struggles that plague us in the world, maybe. Let's take them one at a time. Saguna Brahman is the Brahman we can conceptualize, we can think about. But when you conceptualize something, when you turn it into a thought, you imbue it with all sorts of descriptive qualities. You know, all of a sudden it has qualities: boundless consciousness, infinite compassion, and so on. And to take the next natural step, many people even personify Saguna Brahman. They think about it in human form. They think about it even as a he or a she, and they give it a name. They call it the Father. Or in the number one religion on earth, Christianity, they call it Jesus. So the personification of ultimate reality is really a ubiquitous phenomenon. It happens all over the place, in every century, in every culture, on every continent. People everywhere have done this. They have conceptualized ultimate reality as a kind of human or quasi-human consciousness. So here the claim is that God literally became a person in Christianity. You know, Christianity is, as I said, the dominant tradition on the planet. About one out of three people on earth claims some sort of affiliation with the Christian tradition. And for most mainstream Christians, of course, Jesus is understood as the human form of Jesus. Talk about personification, right? They really went all the way with it. That is also found in some of the Indian religious or devotional traditions as well, where the various gods, Vishnu particularly, takes human form. They're called avatars in India. Krishna is an avatar of Vishnu. So this is not unusual. In fact, it's the norm to personify God so completely that it becomes literally a person, walking around talking person. And then before we rush on to the other less personal form, let's give devotional religion its due, even if it isn't your cup of tea. In India, as in many places, this is the dominant form of religion, devotional religion, worship. And in India, they have a lot of gods to choose from, as you probably know. So you could say, really, that the two largest religions on earth, Christianity and Islam, one out of three people is a Christian. One out of four people on earth is a Muslim. About 1.7 billion Muslims on the planet. It's also the fastest growing religion on earth. So Christianity and Islam together form the really dominant human religious perspective. And they both have a somewhat personified notion of ultimate reality as a being, a conscious being who has thoughts and intentions and plans and desires and all of that. So when we conceptualize God in the personal form, it really opens up a rich opportunity for most people, an opportunity to connect, to have direct experience through the heart chakra, through the love muscle, with ultimate reality. They don't want to sit through a philosophy lecture or endure a theological text. They want to love and be loved without intellectualization. That's how most people do it. Again, for you and I, that might not be the case. So that avenue of devotion is not open to the more cerebral among us who prefer rational discernment and the cleanliness of intellectual abstraction. They don't like the messy juiciness of love. Can I get an amen? Yeah. Yeah, all right. So it, you know, different communities all over town, all over the world do this differently, obviously. But to experience God directly in loving relationship and in turn to be known by God on a personal level, this is a profoundly beautiful and powerful spiritual path that is for most religious people the bee's knees, the ultimate. But it isn't a good fit for everybody. Probably a couple people in here who are not really caught by that emotional kind of religiosity. So let's talk about the other way of approaching Brahman, Nirguna Brahman, Brahman without concepts, without qualities, without characteristics, beyond the grasp of the conceptual mind. Really, only philosophers can love this. The only appropriate thing to say about Nirguna Brahman is silence. Or in Sanskrit, neti neti means it's not this, it's not that. It's how the Christian mystics of the Middle Ages talked about God in Latin, via negativa, the negative way. I cannot say what God is, I can only say what God is not. This is Nirguna Brahman, Brahman without concepts. This is the impersonal God of the philosophers, like Lao Tzu, the great Chinese philosopher and author of the Chinese wisdom classic, the Tao Te Ching, who begins that book with that immortal line, the Tao that can be told is not the eternal Tao. So he starts right out of the gate with that idea that ultimate reality cannot be thought. It can be experienced, but not intellectually, not conceptually. And, you know, to be completely honest, some of us are frustrated and a bit put off by personifications of ultimate reality. It's problematic for us to take ultimate reality and ram it into a little doll and call it male or female and give it a name. That seems at best inappropriate and at worst blasphemous to us. Because once you drag the infinite boundlessness down into the realm of conceptualization, it becomes distorted by the prejudices of those doing the personifying. Yeah? So, for example, in patriarchal societies, God is, of course, male. Because you take your human notion of power and project it onto the heavens. And in matriarchal societies, no, don't have those anymore yet. Naturally, God becomes a woman. And in times of war, God is a war god who helps you vanquish your enemies. And for peace activists, God is a god of peace and mercy and healing and connection. So you get the God you want. You get the God you need. In many ways, you get the God you deserve. Now, you may recall that in the Bible, the book of Exodus, in the second commandment, God warns us to make no graven images of him. This is a God who does not want to be depicted in material form. And Jews and Muslims stick very closely to that ancient idea to this day. So this is a sky god, an imageless god who lives in the realm beyond the five senses and maybe even beyond the confines of our conceptual mind. Now, here's an interesting question. Are not God concepts, in a way, graven images, idols even. Is not certainty about God, in the end, a form of idolatry? The worship of one's own concepts. Have you not then turned something other than God into a god? Are you not then worshiping at the altar of your own conceptual construction? Are you not then violating the first commandment? You shall have no other gods before me. So this is an intriguing problem that comes up in religious studies. When we overly define God, when we overly conceptualize God, have we not in fact created a graven image that we bow down to, which in fact obstructs our connection to ultimate reality? Father Richard Rohr puts it this way: the only sin is certainty. So the mystics in the room kind of get that one. So which is the better path or approach, the personal God or the impersonal God? Well, we know where the mystics stand, and we've already heard from one, St. Augustine, with his line that I already gave you: if you comprehend it, it is not God. We think we know where he would fall. He's more of an impersonal God guy. And yet, in many ways, the father of Roman Catholicism, St. Augustine, which more than any other Christian denomination personifies God. But there's another great mystic, the Sufi Muslim poet many of you are familiar with, Rumi. Born in what today we would call Afghanistan, although back then in the 12th century he was part of the Persian Empire, so Iran claims him as a native son as well. But Rumi is one of the best-selling poets in the United States today. I can never get tired of the deliciousness of that idea, that a 12th century Muslim poet is one of the best-selling poets in America today. That shows you how little poetry sells. But I want to share with you a story from Rumi. As a Muslim, as a Sufi, as a mystic, he was, of course, a great student of Judaism and Christianity and everything else he could get his hands on. So Rumi tells this story, an apocryphal story. That means it's made up. An apocryphal story about Moses that I just adore. And it kind of opens up this theme that we've been thinking about with you. So let me read. It'll take a minute or maybe a minute and a half. Let me read this story to you about Moses from Rumi. Moses heard a shepherd on the road praying, "God, where are you? I want to help you to fix your shoes and comb your hair. I want to wash your clothes and pick the lice off. I want to bring you milk to kiss your little hands and feet when it's time for you to go to bed. I want to sweep your room and keep it neat. God, my sheep and goats are yours. All I can say remembering you is I and ah." Moses could stand it no longer. "Who are you talking to?" Moses said. And the shepherd said, "The one who made us, who made the earth and made the sky." And Moses says, "Don't talk about shoes and socks with God. And what's this with your little hands and feet? Such blasphemous familiarity sounds like you're chatting with your uncles. Only something that grows needs milk. Only someone with feet needs shoes, not God." So you see the tension here so far. The shepherd really digs the personified God idea, and Moses is a little bit up here, right? Moses continues, "Use appropriate terms. Body and birth language are right for us on this side of the river, but not for addressing the origin, not for Allah." The shepherd repented and tore his clothes and sighed and wandered out into the desert. I mean, Moses just crushed him. But watch what happens now. A sudden revelation came to Moses. God's voice. "You have separated me from one of my own. Did you not come as a prophet to unite or to sever? I have given each being a separate and unique way of seeing and knowing and saying that knowledge. What seems wrong to you is right for him. What is poison to one is honey to someone else. Purity and impurity, sloth and diligence in worship, these mean nothing to me, God said. I am apart from all that. Ways of worshiping are not to be ranked as better or worse than one another. Hindus do Hindu things. The Dravidian Muslims in India do what they do. It's all praise. It's all right. It's not me that's glorified in acts of worship, God said. It's the worshipers. I don't hear the words they say. I look inside at the humility. That broken, open lowliness is the reality, not the language. Forget phraseology. I want burning, burning. Be friends with your burning. Burn up your thinking and your forms of expression. Moses, those who pay attention to ways of behaving and speaking are one sort. Lovers who burn are another. Rumi is laying intellectualism to waste with this story. In fact, in this story, devotion seems to be placed in a superior position to intellectualizing. So I think maybe we'll start to wrap it up here that in the end, maybe this dichotomy, this distinction between personified God and impersonal God, maybe it doesn't even matter. Because both the impersonal God and the personal God aren't real. They are just ways of thinking and are ways of approaching that which is real, namely the divine reality beyond thought, which gave rise to all of this. So maybe there's no need to argue about God concepts. I used to do that a lot. And it got boring. And I started reading more Rumi. And I realized almost every argument about religion comes from one place and one place alone, and that is the ego. And the need for you and your tribe to be the right tribe and for everyone else to be somehow steps removed, to be regarded with respect and patronized, but distant from, you know, you guys who've got it. And that whole game just fell apart for me. And it's humbling to realize that your concepts are just as self-constructed as everybody else's concepts. But this is not an atheistic argument. Because the atheists would say, well, there's nothing behind all the concepts. You made it all up out of your own neurotic needs, you know, Freud and all that. But for spiritual folk, we say, well, all the concepts are provisional, but that which lies beyond them, I experience that directly, not as a thought. I feel it. There are different epistemologies. There are different ways of knowing. And so all concepts, the personal God, the impersonal God, all concepts are merely our imperfect way of struggling to apprehend with these limited minds that which is inherently unlimited. So in the end, maybe we ought to set ourselves free, free to laugh and pray and meditate and serve as we see fit, as our sacred freedom allows, and where our inner light leads us, like that shepherd on the road, or like Rumi. So finally, I'll leave you with this. What if we chose to trust that all of this was God. And that truth is not something to be found, but something to be acknowledged and allowed as it wells up continuously through the cracks of our suffering. And shows up one way for me and one way for you and another way for somebody else. What if we trusted that we are safe here, right here, in the loving arms of our Mother Father? No matter how dark it gets, or how far afield we feel, we are always home and in the sacred presence, here and now. Namaste. Thank you.